Listen and Live Audio presents How to Talk to Anyone. Written and read by Leo Lowndes.
Here's how to get anything you want from anybody. Well, at least have the best crack at it. Have you ever admired those successful people who seem to have it all? You see them chatting confidently at business meetings and comfortably at social parties. They're the ones with the best jobs, the nicest spouses, the finest friends, and the biggest bank accounts and most fashionable zip codes. But wait a minute. A lot of them aren't smarter than you. They're not more educated than you. They're not even better looking. So what is it? Some people suspect they inherited it. Others say they married it or were just plain lucky. You tell them to think again. What it boils down to is their more skillful way of dealing with fellow human beings. You see, nobody gets to the top alone. Over the years, people who seem to have it all have captured the hearts and conquered the minds of hundreds of others who helped boost them, rung by rung, to the top of whatever corporate or social ladder they chose. Wannabes, wandering around at the foot of the ladder, often gaze up and grouse that the big boys and the big girls at the top are snobs. When big players don't give them their friendship, love, or business, they call them cliquish, or accuse them of belonging to an old boy network. The complaining little leaguers never realize that the rejection was their own fault. They'll never know that they blew the affair, the friendship, or the deal due to their own communications fumbles. It's as though well-liked people have a bag of tricks, a magic, a Midas touch that turns everything they do into success. What's in their bag of tricks? You'll find a lot of things. There's a substance that solidifies friendships, a wizardry that wins minds, and a magic that makes people fall in love with them. There's also a quality that makes bosses hire and then promote, a characteristic that keeps clients coming back, and an asset that makes customers want to buy from them and not the competition. We all have a few of those tricks in our bags, some more than others. Those with a whole lot of them are big winners in life. How to Talk to Anyone gives you many of these little tricks that they use every day so that you, too, can play the game to perfection and get whatever you want in life. Part 1. How to Intrigue Everyone Without Saying a Word. The moment two humans lay eyes on each other has an awesome potency. The first sight of you is a brilliant holograph. It burns its way into your new acquaintance's eyes and can stay emblazoned in his or her memory forever. First impressions are indelible. Why? Because in our fast-paced information overload world of multiple stimuli bombarding us every second, people's heads are spinning. They must form quick judgments to make sense of the world and get on with what they have to do. So, whenever people meet you, they take an instant mental snapshot. That image of you becomes the data that they deal with for a very long time. Is their data accurate? Amazingly enough, yes. Even before your lips part and the first syllable escapes, the essence of you has already axed its way into their brains. A friend of mine, Karen, is a highly respected professional in the home furnishings business. Her husband is an equally big name in the communications field. They have two small sons. Whenever Karen is at a home furnishings event, everyone pays deference to her. She's a VIP, a very important person in that world. Her colleagues at conventions jostle for positions just to be seen casually chatting with her. Yet, when she accompanies her husband to communications functions, she might as well be a nobody. When she takes her kids to school functions, she's just another mom. She once asked me, "Leo, how can I stand out from the crowd so people who don't know me will approach and at least assume I'm an interesting person?" The techniques in this section accomplish precisely that. 1. Here's how to make your smile magically different. Use the flooding smile technique. I have an old college friend named Missy, who just last year took over her family business, a Midwestern company supplying corrugated boxes to manufacturers. One day she called saying she was coming to New York to court new clients, and she invited me to dinner with several of her prospects. I was looking forward to once again seeing my friend's quicksilver smile and hearing her contagious laugh. Missy was an incurable giggler, and that was part of her charm. She, I, and three of her potential clients met in the cocktail lounge of a Midtown restaurant, and as we led them into the dining room, Missy whispered in my ears, "Please call me Melissa tonight." Of course I winked back. Not many company presidents are called Missy. Soon after the maitre d' seated us, I began noticing Melissa was a very different woman from the giggling girl I'd known in college. She was just as charming. She smiled as much as ever. Yet something was different. I couldn't quite put my finger on it. Although she was still as effervescent, I had the distinct impression that everything Melissa said was more insightful and sincere. She was responding with genuine warmth to her prospective clients, and I could tell that they liked her. I was thrilled because my friend was scoring a knockout that night. By the end of the evening, Melissa had three big new clients. Afterward, alone in the cab with her, I said, "Missy, you've really come a long way since you took over the company. Your whole personality has developed, well, a really cool, sharp corporate edge." "Uh-uh. Only one thing has changed," she said. "What's that?" I asked. "My smile," she said. "Your what?" I asked incredulously. "My smile," she repeated as though I hadn't heard her. "You see, when Dad got sick and knew in a few years that I'd have to take over the business, he sat me down and had a life-changing conversation with me. I'll never forget his words. Dad said, 'Missy, honey, remember that old song? I loves you, honey, but your feet's too big. Well, if you're going to make it big in the box business, let me say, I loves you, honey, but your smile's too quick.'" Missy told me he then brought out a yellowed newspaper article quoting a study he'd been saving to show me when the time was right. It concerned women in business. The study showed women who were slower to smile in corporate life were perceived as more credible. Missy continued, "The study went on to say a big, warm smile is an asset, but only when it comes a little slower, because then it has more credibility." From that moment on, Missy explained, she gave clients and business associates her big smile. However, she trained her lips to erupt more slowly. Thus, her smile appeared more sincere and personalized for the recipient. That was it. Missy's slower smile gave her personality a richer, deeper, more sincere cachet. Although the delay was less than a second, the recipients of her beautiful big smile felt it was special and just for them. Technique number one, the flooding smile. Don't flash an immediate smile when you greet someone as though anyone who walked into your line of sight would be the beneficiary. Instead, look at the other person's face for a second. Pause. Soak in their persona. Then let a big, warm, responsive smile flood over your face and overflow into your eyes. It will engulf the recipient like a warm wave. The split-second delay convinces people your flooding smile is genuine and only for them. 2. Here's how to strike everyone as intelligent and insightful by using your eyes. Use the sticky eyes technique. It's only a slight exaggeration to say Helen of Troy could sink ships with her eyes and Davy Crockett could stare down a bear. Your eyes are personal grenades that have the power to detonate people's emotions. Exaggerated eye contact can be extremely advantageous, especially between the sexes. In business, even when romance is not in the picture, strong eye contact packs a powerful wallop between men and women. A Boston center conducted a study to learn the precise effects. the researchers asked opposite-sex individuals to have a 2-minute casual conversation. They tricked half of their subjects into maintaining intense eye contact by directing them to count the number of times their partner blinked. They gave the other half of the subjects no special eye contact directions for the chat. When they questioned the subjects afterward, the unsuspecting blinkers reported significantly higher feelings of respect and fondness for their colleagues, who, unbeknownst to them, had simply been counting their blinks. There is yet another argument for intense eye contact. In addition to awakening feelings of respect and affection, maintaining strong eye contact gives you the impression of being an intelligent and abstract thinker. Because you see, abstract thinkers integrate incoming data more easily than concrete thinkers, they can continue looking into someone's eyes, even during the silences. Their thought processes are not distracted by peering into their partner's peepers. Back to our valiant psychologists. Yale researchers, thinking they had the unswerving truth about eye contact, conducted another study which they assumed would confirm that the more eye contact, the more the positive feelings. This time, they directed subjects to deliver a personally revealing monologue. They asked the listeners to react with a sliding scale of eye contact when their partners talked. The results? All went as expected when women told their personal stories to other women. The increased eye contact encouraged the feelings of intimacy. But whoops, it wasn't so with the men. Some men felt hostile when stared at too long by another man. Others felt threatened. Some few even suspected their partner was more interested than he should be, and they wanted to slug him. Your partner's emotional reaction to your profound gaze has a biological base. When you look intently at someone, it increases their heartbeat, and it shoots an adrenaline-like substance gushing through their veins. This is the same physical reaction people have when they start to fall in love. And when you consciously increase your eye contact, even during normal business or social interactions, people will feel that they have captivated you. So, men talking to women, and women talking to men or women, use the following technique, which I call sticky eyes. It's for the joy of the recipient and for your own advantage. Technique number 2, sticky eyes. Pretend that your eyes are glued to your conversation partner's with sticky, warm taffy. Don't break eye contact, even after he or she has finished speaking. When you must look away, do it ever so slowly, reluctantly, stretching the gooey taffy until the tiny string finally breaks. Now, gentlemen, when talking to other men, you too can use sticky eyes. Just make them a little less sticky when discussing personal matters with other men. But do increase your eye contact slightly more than normal with men on a normal day-to-day basis, and a lot more when talking to women. It broadcasts a visceral message of comprehension and respect. 3. Here's how to use your eyes to make someone fall in love with you. Use the epoxy eyes technique. Now we haul in the heavy eyeball artillery. Very sticky eyes or super glue eyes. Let's call them epoxy eyes. Big bosses use epoxy eyes to evaluate employees. Police investigators use epoxy eyes to intimidate suspected criminals. And clever Romeos use epoxy eyes to make women fall in love with them. The epoxy eyes technique takes at least 3 people to pull it off. You, your target, and 1 other person. Here's how it works. Usually, when you're chatting with 2 or more people, you gaze at the person who is speaking. However, the epoxy eyes technique suggests you concentrate on the listener, your target, rather than the speaker. This slightly disorients target person, and he or she silently asks, "Why is this person looking at me instead of the speaker?" Target senses that you are extremely interested in his or her reactions. This can be very beneficial in certain business situations, when it's appropriate that you judge the listener. When you use epoxy eyes, it sends out signals of interest blended with complete confidence in yourself. But because epoxy eyes put you in a position of evaluating or judging someone, you must be careful. Don't overdo it, or you could come across as arrogant and brazen. Technique number 3. Epoxy eyes. This bold technique packs a powerful punch. Watch your target person even when someone else is talking. No matter who is speaking, keep looking at the man or woman you want to impact. Sometimes using full epoxy eyes is too potent. So here is a gentler yet very effective form. Watch the speaker, but let your glance bounce to your target each time the speaker finishes a point. This way, Mr. or Mrs. Target still feels that you are intrigued by his or her reactions, yet there is some relief from the intensity. If romance is on the horizon, epoxy eyes transmits yet another message. It says, "I can't take my eyes off of you," or "I only have eyes for you." Anthropologists have called eyes the initial organ of romance. It's because studies show that intense eye contact plays havoc with our heartbeat. Men, epoxy eyes is extremely effective on women, if they find you attractive. The lady interprets her nervous reaction to your untoward gaze as budding infatuation. If she does not like you, however, your epoxy eyes are downright obnoxious. By the way, never use epoxy eyes on strangers in public settings. You might get arrested. 4. Here's how to look like a big winner wherever you go. Use the hang-by-your-teeth technique. Do you remember the lyrics to the old Shirley Bassey song? It says, "The minute you walked in the joint, I could see you were a man of distinction, a real big spender. Good-looking, so refined. Say, wouldn't you like to know what's going on in my mind?" The goal of this first section is not to make you look like a real big spender. Rather, it is to give you the cachet of a real big somebody the moment that people lay eyes on you. To that end, we now explore the most important technique to make you look like a very important person. When the doctor smacks your knee with that nasty little hammer, your foot jerks forward. Thus the phrase, knee-jerk reaction. Your body has another instinctive reaction. When a big jolt of happiness hits your heart and you feel like a winner, your head jerks up automatically and you throw your shoulders back. A smile frames your lips and it softens your eyes. This is the look that winners have constantly. They stand with assurance. They move with confidence. They smile softly with pride. No doubt about it. Good posture symbolizes that you are a man or a woman who is used to being on top. Here is a visualization technique to get your body looking like a winner who is in the habit of feeling that pride, that success, and that joy of being alive. Technique number 4, hang by your teeth. Visualize a circus iron jaw bit hanging from the frame of every door you walk through. Take a bite, and with it firmly between your teeth, let it swoop you to the peak of the big top. When you hang there by your teeth, every muscle is stretched into perfect posture position. You are now ready to float into the room to captivate the crowd, or close the sale, or maybe just settle for looking like the most important somebody in the room. 5. Here's how to win their heart by responding to their inner infant. Use the big baby technique. Remember the old joke? The comic comes on stage, and the first words out of his mouth are, "Well, how do you like me so far?" The audience always cracks up. Why? Because we all silently ask that question. Whenever we meet someone, we know, consciously or subconsciously, how they're reacting to us. The first few moments of your reactions set the stage upon which the entire relationship will be played out. If you ever want anything from new acquaintance, your unspoken answer to their unspoken question, "How do you like me so far?" must be, "Wow, I really like you." Once I was at a corporate star-studded party with an attractive, recently divorced friend of mine. Carla had been a copywriter with one of the leading advertising agencies, which, like so many companies at that time, had downsized. my girlfriend was both out of work and out of a relationship. At this particular party, the pickings for Carla were good, both personally and professionally. Several times as Carla and I stood talking, one good-looking corporate male beast or another would find himself within a few feet of us. More often than not, one of these desirable males would flash his teeth at Carla. She sometimes graced the tentatively courting male with a quick smile over her shoulder. But then she'd turn back to our mundane conversation, as though she were hanging on my every word. I knew she was trying not to look anxious, but inside Carla was crying out, "Why doesn't he come speak to me?" Right after one prize, corporate big cat smiled, but due to Carla's minimal reaction, wandered back into the social jungle. I had to say, "Carla, do you know who that was? He's the head of Y&R in Paris. They're looking for copywriters willing to relocate. And he's single." Carla moaned. Just then we heard a little voice down by Carla's left knee. "Hello." We looked down simultaneously. Little 5-year-old Willie, the host's adorable young son, was tugging on Carla's skirt, obviously craving attention. "Well, well, well," Carla cried out, a big smile erupting all over her face. Carla turned toward him. Carla kneeled down. Carla touched little Willie's elbow, and Carla crooned, "Well, hello there, Willie. How are you enjoying Mummy and Daddy's nice party?" Little Willie beamed. When little Willie finally trundled off to tug on the garments of the next group of potential attention givers, Carla and I returned to our grown-up conversing. During our chat, corporate beasts continued to stalk Carla with their eyes, and Carla continued casting only half-smiles at them. She was obviously disappointed none of them were making further approach. I had to bite my tongue, but finally, when I felt my tongue was going to bleed from the pressure of my teeth, I said, "Carla, have you been noticing that 4 or 5 men have come over and smiled at you?" "Yes," Carla whispered, her eyes darting nervously around the room lest anyone overhear us. "And you've been giving them little half smiles," I continued. "Yes," she murmured, now confused at my question. "Remember when little Willie came up and tugged on your skirt? Do you recall how you smiled that beautiful big smile of yours? You turned toward him and welcomed him into our grown-up conversation?" "Yes," she answered haltingly. "Well, I have a request, Carla. The next man who smiles at you, I want you to give him that big smile that you gave Willie. I want you to turn toward him just like you did then. Maybe even reach out and touch his arm like you did little Willie's, and then welcome him into our conversation." "Oh, Leal, I couldn't do that," she said. "Carla, do it." Sure enough, within a few minutes, another attractive man wandered our way and smiled. Carla played her role to perfection. She flashed her beautiful teeth, turned fully toward him, and said, "Hello, come join us." He wasted no time accepting Carla's invitation. After a few moments, I excused myself. Neither noticed my departure because they were in animated conversation. The last glimpse I had of my friend at the party was her floating out the door on the arm of her new friend. Just then, the technique that I call Big Baby Pivot was born. It's a skill that will help you win whatever your heart desires from whatever type of beasts you encounter in the social or the corporate jungle. Technique number 5, the Big Baby Pivot. Give everyone you meet the Big Baby Pivot. The instant the two of you are introduced, reward your new acquaintance. Give the warm smile, the total body turn, and the undivided attention you would give a tiny tyke who crawled up to your feet, turned a precious face up to yours, and beamed a big, toothless grin. Pivoting 100% toward new person shouts, "I think you are very, very special." 6. Here's how to make people feel like you're their old friend immediately. Use the hello, old friend technique. A very wise man with a funny name of Zig once told me, "People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care about them." Zig Ziglar is right. The secret to making people like you is showing how much you like them. Your body is a 24-hour broadcasting station, revealing to anyone within eyeshot precisely how you feel at any given moment. Every inch, from the crinkle of your forehead to the position of your feet, must give a command performance if you want to effectively present an I care about you attitude. Unfortunately, when meeting someone, our brains are in overdrive. When our bodies are shooting off skillions of stimuli, a few shots are apt to misfire and reveal shyness or hidden hostility. We need a technique to assure that every shot aims right at the heart of our subject. We need to trick our bodies into reacting perfectly. To find it, let's explore the only time we don't need to worry about any shyness or negativity slipping out through our body language. It's when we feel none. That happens when we're chatting with close friends. When we see someone we love or feel completely comfortable with, we respond warmly from head to toe without a thought. Our lips part happily. We step closer. Our arms reach out. Our eyes become soft and wide. Even our palms turn up and our bodies turn fully toward our dear friend. Here's a visualization technique that accomplishes all that. It guarantees that everyone you encounter will feel your warmth. Technique number 6. Hello, old friend. When meeting someone, imagine that he or she is an old friend, or an old customer, an old beloved, or someone else that you had great affection for. How sad. The vicissitudes of life tore you two asunder. But holy mackerel, now the party, or the meeting, the convention, has reunited you with your long-lost dear old friend. The joyful experience starts a remarkable chain reaction in your body, from the subconscious softening of your eyebrows to the positioning of your toes, and everything else in between. 7. Here's how to come across 100% credible to everyone. Use the limit the fidget technique. I have a friend, a highly respected headhunter named Helen. Helen makes terrific hires for her clients. I once asked her the secret of her success. She said, "Probably because I can almost always tell when an applicant is lying." "How can you tell?" I asked. She said, "Well, just last week, I was interviewing a young woman for a position as marketing director for a small firm. Throughout the interview, the applicant had been sitting with her left leg crossed over her right. Her hands were comfortably resting in her lap, and she was looking directly at me. I asked her salary. Without swerving her eyes from mine, she told me. I asked her if she enjoyed her work. Still looking directly at me, she said yes. Then I asked her why she had left her previous job. Helen said, at that point her eyes fleetingly darted away before regaining eye contact with me. Then, while answering my question, she shifted in her seat and crossed her right leg over her left. At one point, she put her hand up to her mouth. Helen said, that's all I needed. With her words, she was telling me she felt her, quote, growth opportunities were limited at her previous firm. But her body told me she was not being entirely forthright. Helen continued, so I tested it. I changed the subject and went back to more neutral territory. I asked her about her goals for the future. Again, the girl stopped fidgeting. She folded her hands in her lap as she told me how she'd always wanted to work in a small company in order to have hands-on experience with more than just one project. Then I repeated my earlier question. I asked again if it was only the lack of growth opportunity that made her leave her previous position. Sure enough, once again the woman shifted in her seat and momentarily broke eye contact. As she continued talking about the job, she started rubbing her forearm. Helen continued to probe until she finally uncovered the truth. The applicant had been fired due to a nasty disagreement with the marketing director she'd worked for. Problems arise for us even when we are not lying, but if we're feeling emotional or intimidated by the person we're talking with. A young man telling an attractive woman about his business success might shift his weight. A woman talking about her company's track record to an important client could rub her neck. More problems arise out of the atmosphere. A businessman who doesn't feel nervous at all could loosen his collar because the room is hot. A politician giving a speech outdoors could blink excessively because the air is dusty. Even though erroneous, these fidgety moves give their listeners the sense that something just isn't right, or a gut feeling that they're lying. Professional communicators are alert to this hazard. They consciously squelch any signs that anyone could mistake for shiftiness. They suffer because they know that fidgeting undermines credibility. Consider the famous 1960 televised debate between Richard Milhouse Nixon and John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Political pundits speculate that Nixon's lack of makeup, his fidgeting, and constantly mopping his brow on camera lost him the election. Technique number 7. Limit the fidget. Whenever your conversation really counts, let your nose itch, your ear tingle, or your foot prickle. Do not fidget, twitch, wiggle, squirm, or scratch. And above all, keep your paws away from your puss. Hand motions near your face and all fidgeting can give your listeners the gut feeling that you are fibbing. 8. Here's how to read people like you have ESP. Use the horse sense technique. A very clever horse named Hans inspires this next technique. Hans was owned by Erwan Osten, a Berliner, who had trained Hans to do simple arithmetic by tapping his right front hoof. So prodigious was Hans' ability that the horse's fame quickly spread throughout Europe in the early 1900s. He became known as Clever Hans, the counting horse. Erwan Osten taught Hans to do more than just add. Soon the horse could subtract and divide. In time, Clever Hans even mastered the multiplication tables. The horse became quite a phenomenon. Without the owner uttering a single word, Hans could count out the size of his audience, tap the number wearing glasses, or respond to any counting question they asked him. Finally, Hans achieved the ultimate ability that separates man from animal, language. Hans learned the alphabet. By tapping out hoofbeats for each letter, he answered any question about anything that humans had read in the newspaper or heard on the radio. He could even answer common questions about history, geography, and human biology. Hans made headlines and was the main topic of discussion at dinner parties all throughout Europe. The human horse quickly attracted the attention of scientists, psychology professors, veterinarians, even cavalry officers. Naturally, they were skeptical, so they established an official commission to decide whether the horse was a case of clever trickery or equine genius. The day of the big test arrived. Everyone was convinced it must be a trick orchestrated by Erwan Osten, the owner. There was standing room only in the auditorium. It was filled with scientists, reporters, clairvoyants, psychics, and horse lovers who eagerly awaited the answer. The canny commission members were confident that this was the day they would expose Hans as chicanery, because they, too, had a trick up their sleeves. They were going to bar Van Osten from the hall and put his horse to the test all alone. When the crowd was assembled, they told Van Osten he must leave the auditorium. The surprised owner departed, and Hans was stranded in the auditorium with a suspicious and anxious audience. The confident commission leader asked Hans the first mathematical question. He tapped the right answer. A second, he got it right. Then a third. Then the language questions followed. Hans got them all right. The commission was befuddled, and the critics were silenced. However, the public wasn't. With a great outcry, they insisted on a new commission. The world waited while once again the authorities gathered scientists, professors, veterinarians, and reporters from all over the world. Only after the second commission put Hans to the test did the truth about the clever horse come out. Commission number 2 started the inquiry perfunctorily with simple addition problems. This time, however, instead of asking the question out loud for all to hear, one researcher whispered a number in Hans' ear, and a second researcher whispered another. Everyone expected Hans to quickly tap out the sum. But Hans remained dumb. Aha! The researchers revealed the truth to the waiting world. Can you guess what it was? Here it is. People had given off very subtle body language signals the moment Hans's hoof gave the right number of taps. When Hans started tapping the answer to a question, the audience would show subtle signs of tension. Then, when Hans reached the right number, they responded by an expulsion of breath or a slight relaxation of muscles. Van Austin had trained Hans to stop tapping at that point and therefore appear to give the right answer. Hans was using the technique I call horse sense. He watched his audience's reaction very carefully and planned his responses accordingly. Have you ever been watching TV when the phone rings? Someone asks you to hit the mute button on the television so they can talk. Because there's no sound now, you watch the TV action more carefully. You see performers smiling, scowling, smirking, squinting, and scores of other expressions. You don't miss a beat of the story, because just from their expressions, you can tell what they're really thinking. Hans Horse Sense is just that. Watching people, seeing how they're reacting, and then making your moves accordingly. Even while you're talking, keep your eyes on your listener and watch how they are responding to what you are saying. Don't miss a trick. Technique number 8, horse sense. Make it a habit to get on a dual track while talking. Express yourself, but keep a keen eye on how your listener is reacting to what you're saying. Then plan your moves accordingly. If a horse can do it, so can a human. People will say you pick up on everything. You never miss a trick. You've got horse sense. 9. Here's how to make sure that you don't miss a single beat. Use the, quote, watch the scene before you make the scene technique. You've seen professional skiing on television. The athlete at the top of the piste, every muscle primed and poised, waiting for the gun to propel him to ultimate victory. Look deeply into his eyes, and you will see he is having an out-of-body experience. In his mind's eye, the skier is swooshing down the slope, zapping back and forth between the poles, and sliding across the finish line in a faster time than the world thought possible. The athlete is visualizing. All athletes do it. They visualize their magic before performing it. They see their own bodies bending, twisting, flapping, flying through the air. They hear the sound of the wind, the splash of the water, the whir of the javelin, and the thud of its landing. They smell the grass, the cement, the pool, the dust. Before they move a muscle, professional athletes watch the whole movie, which, of course, ends in their own victory. Psychological mumbo-jumbo? Absolutely not. I have a friend, Richard, who runs marathons. Once, several years ago, a scant 3 weeks before the big New York Marathon, an out-of-control car crashed into Richard's, and he was taken to the hospital. He was not badly injured. Nevertheless, his friends were sorry for him, because being laid up 2 weeks in the bed would naturally knock him out of the big event. What a surprise when, on that crisp November marathon morning in Central Park, Richard showed up in his little shorts and big running shoes. "Richard, are you crazy? You're in no shape to run. You've been in bed these past few weeks," we all cried out. "My body may have been in bed," he replied, "but I've been running." "What?" we all asked in unison. "Yes, every day I ran the whole thing in my mind. 26 miles, 385 yards, right there on my mattress." Richard didn't do as well as he had the year before, but the miracle is he finished the marathon without injury and without excessive fatigue. It was all due to his visualization. Visualization works in just about any endeavor you apply it to, including being a terrific communicator. Visualization works best when you feel totally relaxed. Only when you have a calm state of mind can you get clear, vivid images. Do your visualization in the quiet of your home or car before leaving for the party, the convention, the big deal meeting. See it all in your mind's eye ahead of time. Technique number 9, watch the scene before you make the scene. Rehearse being the super somebody you want to be ahead of time. See yourself walking around with that hang-by-your-teeth posture, shaking hands, smiling the flooding smile, and making sticky eyes. Hear yourself chatting comfortably with everyone. Feel the pleasure of knowing you are in peak form and everyone is gravitating toward you. Visualize yourself a super somebody, and then it all happens automatically. Part 2. What do I say after I say hi? Just as the first glimpse should please their eyes, your first word should delight their ears. Your tongue is a welcome mat embossed with either welcome or go away. To make your conversation partner feel welcome, you must master small talk. Small talk? Can you hear the shudder? Those two little words drive a stake into the hearts of some otherwise fearless and undaunted souls. Invite them to a party where they don't know anyone, and it mainlines queasiness into their veins. As a shy tot, I spent a lot of time hiding under the table. As a preteen in an all-girls boarding school, my legs turned to linguine every time I had to converse with a male. In eighth grade, I once had to invite a boy to our school prom. The entire selection of dancing males lived in the dormitory of our brother school, and I only knew one resident, Eugene. I had met Eugene at a summer camp the year before. Mustering all my courage, I decided to call him. 2 weeks before the dance, I felt the onset of sweaty palms. I put the call off. 1 week before, rapid heartbeats set in. I put the call off. Finally, 3 days before the big bash, breathing became difficult. Time was running out. The critical moment, I realized, would be easier if I read from a script. I wrote out the following. Hi, this is Leo. We met at a camp last summer, remember? I programmed in a pause where I hoped he'd say yes. Well, National Cathedral School prom is this Saturday night, and I'd like you to be my date. I programmed in another pause where I prayed he'd say yes. On Thursday, before the dance, I could no longer delay the inevitable. I picked up the receiver and dialed. Clutching the phone, waiting for Eugene to answer, my eyes followed the perspiration droplets rolling down my arm and dripping off my elbow. A small, salty puddle was forming around my feet. Hello, a deep, sexy male voice answered the phone. In faster than a speeding bullet voice, like a nervous telemarketer, I shot out, Hi, this is Leo. We met at camp last summer, remember? Forgetting to pause for his assent, I raced on. Well, National Cathedral's prom is this Saturday night, and I'd like you to be my date. To my relief and delight, I heard a big, cheerful, Oh, that's great. I'd love to. I exhaled my first normal breath all day. He continued, I'll pick you up at the girls' dorm at 7:30. I'll have a pink carnation for you. Will that go with your dress? Oh, and my name is Donnie. Donnie? Donnie? Who said anything about Donnie? Well, Donnie turned out to be the best date I had that decade. Donnie had buck teeth, a head full of tousled red hair, and communication skills that immediately put me at ease. On Saturday night, Donnie greeted me at the door, carnation in hand and grin on face. He joked self-deprecatingly about how he was dying to go to the prom, so knowing that it was a case of mistaken identity, he accepted anyway. He told me he was thrilled when the, quote, girl with a lovely voice called, and he took full responsibility for tricking me into an invitation. Donnie made me comfortable and confident as we chatted. First we made small talk, and then he gradually led me into subjects that I was interested in. I flipped over Donnie, and he became my very first boyfriend. Donnie instinctively had the small talk skills that we are now going to fashion into techniques to help you glide through small talk like a hot knife through butter. When you master them, you will be able, like Donnie, to melt the heart of everyone you touch. 10. Here's how to start great small talk. Use the mood match technique. Several years ago, the Mensa organization, a social group of extremely bright individuals who score in the country's top 2% in intelligence, invited me to be the keynote speaker at their annual convention. I don't know why, because I don't even qualify to be in their group. Anyway, their cocktail party was in full swing in the lobby of the hotel as I arrived. After checking in, I hauled my bags through the horde of happy hour Mensans to the elevator. The doors separated, and I stepped into an elevator packed with partygoers. As we began the journey up to our respective floors, the elevator gave several sleepy jerks. I remarked in response to the elevator's sluggishness. The elevator seems a little flaky. Suddenly, each elevator occupant, feeling compelled to exhibit his or her 132-plus IQ, pounced forth with a thunderous explanation. "Oh, it's obviously got poor rail guide alignment," announced one. "The relay contact is not made up," declared another. Suddenly, I felt like a grasshopper trapped in a stereo speaker. I couldn't wait to escape the attack of the mental giants. Afterward, in the solitude of my room, I thought back and reflected that the Mensen's answers were, indeed, interesting. Why, then, did I have such an adverse reaction? I realized it was too much too soon. I was tired. Their high energy and intensity jarred my sluggish state. You see, small talk is not about facts or words. It's about music, about melody. Small talk is about putting people at ease. It's about making comforting noises together, like cats purring or children humming or groups chanting. You must first match your listener's mood. Instead of jumping in with such intensity, the Mensens could have momentarily matched my lethargic mood by saying, "Yeah, it really is slow, isn't it?" Had they then prefaced their information with, "Have you ever been curious about why an elevator is slow?" I would have responded with a sincere, "Yes, I have." After a moment of equalized energy levels, I would have welcomed their explanations about the rail guard alignment or whatever the heck it was, and a friendship might have started. I'm sure you've suffered the aggression of a mood mismatch. Have you ever been relaxing when some overexcited, hot-breath colleague starts pounding you with questions? Or the reverse. You're late rushing to a meeting when an associate stops you and starts lazily narrating a long, languorous story. No matter how interesting the tale, you don't want to hear it now. The first step in starting a conversation without strangling it too much is to tune in to your listener's mood and match it, if only for a sentence or two. When it comes to small talk, think music, not words. Is your listener adagio or allegro? Match that pace. I call it making a mood match. Technique number 10, make a mood match. Before opening your mouth, take a voice sample of your listener to detect his or her state of mind. Take a psychic photograph of the expression to see if your listener looks buoyant, bored, or blitzed. If you ever want to bring people around to your thoughts, you must match their mood and tone of voice, if only for a moment. 11. Here's how to sound like you've got a super personality, no matter what you're saying. Use the prosaic with passion technique. I was once at a party where I spotted a fellow surrounded by a fan club of avid listeners. The chap was smiling, gesticulating, obviously enthralling his audience. I went over to listen to this fascinating speaker. I joined his throng of admirers and eavesdropped for a minute or two. Suddenly, it dawned on me. The fellow was saying the most mundane things. His script, words, were dull, dull, dull. Ah, but he was delivering his prosaic observations with such passion. Therefore, he held the group spellbound. It convinced me that it's not what you say, it's how you say it. Often people ask me, what's a good opening line when I meet people? I give them the same answer a woman who once worked in my office always gave me. Dottie often stayed at her desk to work through lunch. Sometimes, as I was leaving for the sandwich shop, I'd ask her, "Hey, Dottie, what can I bring you back for lunch?" Dottie, trying to be obliging, would say, "Oh, anything is fine with me." "No, Dottie," I wanted to scream, "tell me what you want. Ham and cheese on rye? Bologna on whole wheat? Hold the mayo? Peanut butter and jelly with sliced bananas? Be specific. Anything is a hassle." Frustrating though it may be, my answer to the opening line question is anything, because almost anything you say is really okay, as long as it puts people at ease and sounds passionate. Technique number 11, prosaic with passion. Worried about your first words? Fear not, since 80% of your listener's impression has nothing to do with your words anyway. Almost anything you say at first is fine. No matter how prosaic the text, an empathetic mood, a positive demeanor, and a passionate delivery make you sound exciting. 12. Here's how to make people want to start a conversation with you. Use the always wear a what's it technique. Singles, proficient at meeting potential sweethearts without the benefit of introduction, in the vernacular that's called making a pickup, have developed a deliciously devious technique that works equally well for social or corporate networking purposes. The technique requires no exceptional skill on your part, only the courage to wear a simple visual prop called a what's it. What's a what's it? A what's it is anything you wear or carry that is unusual. A unique pin, an interesting purse, a strange tie, an amusing hat. A what's it is any object that draws people's attention and inspires them to approach you and ask, what's that? Your what's it can be as subtle or overt as your personality and the occasion permit. I wear around my neck an outmoded pair of glasses that resembles a double monocle. Often the curious have approached me at a gathering and asked, well, what's that? I explain that it's a lorgnette left to me by my grandmother, which, of course, paves the way to discuss hatred of glasses, aging eyes, love or loss of grandmothers, adoration of antique jewelry, any way the inquisitor wants to take it. Perhaps unknowingly, you have fallen prey to this soon-to-be-legendary technique. At a gathering, have you ever noticed someone you would like to talk to? Then you've racked your brain to conjure an excuse to make the approach. What a bounty it was to discover that he or she was wearing some weird, wild, or wonderful something that you could comment on. Technique number 12. Always wear a what's it. Whenever you go to a gathering, wear or carry something unusual to give people who find you the delightful stranger across the crowded room an excuse to approach. Excuse me, I couldn't help but notice your... What is that? 13. Here's how to meet the people you want to meet. Use the who's that technique. Say you have scrutinized the body of the important business contact you want to meet. You've searched in vain from the tip of his cowlick to the toes of his boots. He is not sporting a single what's it. If you strike out on finding something to comment on, resort to the who's it technique. Like a persistent politician, go to the party giver and say, that person over there looks interesting. Who is he or she? Then ask for an introduction. Don't be hesitant. The party giver will be pleased that you find one of the guests interesting. If, however, you are loath to pull a party giver away from his or her other guests, you can still perform who's it. This time, don't ask for a formal introduction. Simply pump the party giver for just enough information to launch you. Find out about the stranger's jobs, interests, or hobbies. Suppose the party giver says, oh, that's Joe Smith. I'm not sure what his job is, but I know he loves to ski. Aha! You have just been given the icebreaker you need. Now you make a beeline for Joe Smith. Hi, you're Joe Smith, aren't you? Susan was just telling me what a great skier you are. Where do you ski? See, you get the idea. Technique number 13. Who's it? Who's it is the most effective, least used, meeting people device ever contrived. Simply ask the party giver to make the introduction or pump for a few facts that you can immediately turn into icebreakers. 14. Here's how to break into a tight crowd. Use the eavesdrop-in technique. The woman you've decided you must meet is wearing no what's it, can't find the host for the who's it technique. To make matters worse, she's deep in conversation with a group of her friends. Seems quite hopeless that you will ever maneuver a meeting, doesn't it? No, it's not. For instance, no obstacle blocks the resolute politician who always has a trick or ten up his or her sleeve. A politico would resort to the eavesdrop-in technique. At parties, stand near the group of people you wish to infiltrate. Then wait for a word or two you can use as a wedge to break into the group. Example, excuse me, I couldn't help overhearing that you, and then whatever is relevant here. I couldn't help overhearing your discussion of Bermuda. I'm going there next month for the first time. Any suggestions? Now you are in the circle and can direct your comments to your intended. Technique number 14, eavesdrop in. No what's it, no host for who's it, no problem. Just sidle up behind the swarm of folks you want to infiltrate and open your ears. Wait for any flimsy excuse and jump in with, excuse me, I couldn't help but overhear. Will they be taken aback? Momentarily. Will they get over it? Momentarily. Will you be in the conversation? Absolutely. 15. Here's how to make the answer to that "Where are you from?" question sound exciting. Use the Never the Naked City technique. You wouldn't dream of going to a party naked, and I hope you wouldn't dream of letting your conversation be exposed naked and defenseless against the two most common assaults. Where are you from, and what do you do? When asked these questions, most people, like clunking a frozen steak on a china platter, drop a brick of frozen geography or baffling job title on the asker's conversational platter. Then they slap on the muzzle. You're at a convention. Everyone you meet will, of course, ask, "And where are you from?" When you give them the short-form Naked City answer, "Oh, I'm from Muscatine, Iowa," what can you expect except a blank stare? Do humanity and yourself a favor. Never, ever give just a one-sentence response to the question, "Where are you from?" Give the asker some fuel for his tank, some fodder for his trough. Give the hungry communicator something to conversationally nibble on. All it takes is an extra sentence or two about your city, some interesting fact, some witty observation, to hook the asker into conversation. Technique number 15. Never the Naked City. Whenever someone asks you the inevitable, "And where are you from?" never, ever unfairly challenge their powers of imagination with a one-word answer. Learn some engaging facts about your hometown that your conversational partners can comment on. Then when they say something clever in response to your bait, they think you are a great conversationalist. A fisherman uses different bait to bag bass or bluefish, and you will obviously throw out different conversational bait to snag simple shrimp or sophisticated sharks. Your hook should relate to the type of person you're speaking with. I'm originally from Washington, D.C. If someone at, say, an art gallery asked me where I was from, I might answer, "Washington, D.C., designed, you know, by the same city planner who designed Paris." This opens up the conversational possibilities to the artistry of city planning, Paris, other cities' plans, European travel, and so forth. At a social party of singles, I'd opt for another answer. "I'm from Washington, D.C. The reason I left there is that there were 7 women to every man when I was growing up." Now the conversation can turn to the ecstasy or the agony of being single, the perceived lack of desirable men everywhere, even flirtatious possibilities. Where do you get your conversational bait? Start by phoning the Chamber of Commerce or Historical Society of your town. Search the web, or open an old-fashioned encyclopedia. They're all rich sources for future stimulating conversations. Learn some history, geography, business statistics, or perhaps a few fun facts to tickle your future friend's funny bones. 16. Here's how to come out a winner every time they ask, "And what do you do?" Use the Never the Naked Job technique. Third only to death and taxes is the assurance that a new acquaintance will soon chirp, "And what do you do?" These few defensive moves help you keep your crackerjack communicator credentials when asked the inevitable question. First, like Never the Naked City, don't toss a short shrift answer in response to the asker's breathless inquiry. You leave a poor fish flopping on the deck when you just say your title. "I'm an actuary, an auditor, an author, an astrophysicist." Have mercy so he or she doesn't feel like a nincompoop outsider asking, what kind of actuizing or auditing, authoring, or astrophysicizing do you do? I still harbor painful recollections of being tongue-tied when confronted by naked job flashers. Like the time a fellow at a dinner party told me, "I am a nuclear scientist." My weak, "Oh, that must be fascinating," reduced me to a mental molecule in his eyes. The chap on my other side announced, "I'm into industrial abrasives," and then paused, waiting for me to be impressed. My, "Well, golly, you must have to be a shrewd judge of character to be in industrial abrasives," didn't fly either. We three sat there in silence the rest of the meal. Technique number 16. Never the Naked Job. When asked the inevitable, "And what do you do?" you may think, "I'm an economist, an educator, an engineer," is giving enough information to engender good conversation. However, to one who is not an economist, educator, or an engineer, you might as well be saying, "Oh, I'm a paleontologist, psychoanalyst, or pornographer." Flesh it out. Throw out some delicious facts about your job for your new acquaintance to munch on. Otherwise, they'll soon excuse themselves, preferring the snacks back at the cheese tray. 17. Here's how to introduce people like a host with the most. Use the never-the-naked introduction technique. It's important to help newly mets through their first nervous moments. "Susan, I'd like you to meet John Smith." "John, this is Susan Jones." "Duh. What do you expect John or Susan to say?" "Smith, that's S-M-I-T-H, isn't it?" Or, "Golly, Susan, well, now there's an interesting name." "Nice try, forget it. Don't blame John or Susan for being less than scintillating." The fault lies with the person who introduced the two the way most people introduce their friends to each other, with naked names. They cast out no line with bait for people to sink their teeth into. Technique number 17, never the naked introduction. When introducing people, don't throw out an unbaited hook and stand there grinning like a big clam, leaving the newly mets to flutter their fins and fish for a topic. Bait the conversational hook to get them in the swim of things. Then you're free to stay or float on to the next networking opportunity. Big winners may not talk a lot, but conversation never dies unwillingly in their midst. When they introduce people, they buy an insurance policy on the conversation with a few simple add-ons. Example, "Susan, I'd like you to meet John. John has a wonderful boat we took a trip on last summer." "John, this is Susan Smith. Susan is editor-in-chief of Shoestring Gourmet Magazine." Padding the introduction this way gives Susan the opportunity to ask what kind of boat John has or where the group went. It gives John an opening to discuss his love of writing or of cooking or of food. The conversation can then naturally expand to travel in general, life on boats, past vacations, favorite recipes or restaurants, budgets, diets, magazines, editorial policy, to infinity. 18. Here's how to resuscitate a dying conversation. Use the be a word detective technique. I have a young friend, Nancy, who works in a nursing home. Nancy cares deeply about the elderly, but often grumbles about how crotchety and laconic some of her patients are. She laments she has difficulty in relating to them. Nancy told me about one especially cantankerous old woman named Mrs. Otis, whom she could never get to open up to her. One day, Nancy confided, "Right after all those rainstorms we had last week, just to make conversation, I remarked to Mrs. Otis, 'Gee, terrible storms we had last week, don't you think?' Well," Nancy continued, "Mrs. Otis practically jumped down my throat. She said in a snippy voice, 'Well, it's been good for the plants.' I asked Nancy how she responded to that." "What could I say?" Nancy answered. "The woman was obviously cutting me off." I asked, "Did you ever think to ask Mrs. Otis if she liked plants?" "Plants?" Nancy said. "Well, yes," I suggested. "Mrs. Otis brought the subject up." I asked Nancy to do me a favor. "Ask her," I begged. Nancy resisted, but I persisted. Just to quiet me down, Nancy promised to ask cantankerous old Mrs. Otis if she liked plants. The next day, a flabbergasted Nancy called me from work. "Leah, how did you know? Not only did Mrs. Otis love plants, she told me she'd been married to a gardener. Today, I had a different problem with Mrs. Otis. I couldn't shut her up. She went on and on about her husband, her gardens, and so forth." Now that you've ignited stimulating conversation, let's explore this technique to keep it hot. Technique number 18, be a word detective. Like a good gumshoe, listen to your conversational partner's every word for clues to his or her preferred topic. The evidence is bound to slip out. Then spring on that subject like a sleuth onto a slip of the tongue. Like Sherlock Holmes, you now have the clue to the subject that is hot for the other person. 19. Here's how to enthrall people with your choice of topic, themselves. Use the swiveling spotlight technique. Several years ago, a girlfriend and I attended a party saturated with a hodgepodge of swell-elegant folks. Everyone we talked to seemed to lead a nifty life. Discussing the party afterward, I asked my friend, "Diane, of all the exciting people at the party, who did you enjoy talking to most?" Without hesitation, she answered, "Oh, by far, Don Smith." "Well, what does Don do?" I asked her. "Well, I'm not sure," she answered. "Where does he live?" "I don't know," Diane responded. "Well, what's he interested in?" "Well, we really didn't talk about his interests." "Diane," I said, "what did you talk about?" "Well," she responded, "I guess we talked mostly about me." "Aha," I said to myself, "Diane has just rubbed noses with a big winner." As it turns out, I had the pleasure of meeting Don several months later. Diane's ignorance about his life piqued my curiosity, so I grilled him for details. As it turns out, Don lives in Paris, has a beach home in the south of France, and a mountain home in the Alps. He travels around the world producing sound and light shows for pyramids and ancient ruins. And he is an avid hang glider and scuba diver. Does this man have an interesting life or what? Yet Don, when meeting Diane, had not said one word about himself. I told Don how pleased Diane was to meet him, yet how little she learned about his life. Don simply replied, "Well, when I meet someone, I learn so much more if I ask about their life. I always try to turn the spotlight on the other person." Truly confident people often do this. They know that they grow more by listening than talking. Obviously, they also captivate the talker more. Technique number 19, the swiveling spotlight. When you meet someone, imagine a giant revolving spotlight between you. When you're talking, the spotlight is on you. When the new person is speaking, it's shining on him or her. If you shine it brightly enough, the stranger will be blinded to the fact that you have hardly said a word about yourself. The longer you keep shining it away from you, the more interesting he or she finds you. 20. Here's how to never need to wonder, "What do I say next?" Use the parroting technique. If you find yourself futilely fanning the embers of a dying conversation, here's a foolproof trick to get the fire blazing again. I call it parroting, after that beautiful tropical bird that captures everyone's heart by simply repeating other people's words. I have a friend, Phil, who sometimes picks me up at the airport. Usually I am so exhausted that I rudely fall asleep in the passenger seat, relegating Phil to nothing more than a chauffeur. After one especially exhausting trip some years ago, I flung my bags in his trunk and flopped onto the front seat. As I was dozing off, he mentioned he'd gone to the theater the night before. Usually I would have just grunted and wafted off into unconsciousness. However, on this particular trip, I had learned the parroting technique and was anxious to try it. "Theater?" I parroted quizzically. "Yes, it was a great show," he replied, fully expecting it to be the last word on the subject before I fell into my usual sleepy stupor. "Great show?" I parroted. Pleasantly surprised by my interest, he said, "Yes, it's a new show by Stephen Sondheim called Sweeney Todd." "Sweeney Todd?" I again parroted. Now Phil was getting fired up. "Yeah, great music and an unbelievably bizarre story." "Bizarre story?" I parroted. Well, that was all Phil needed. For the next half an hour, Phil told me the show's story about a London butcher who went around murdering people. I half-dozed, but soon decided his tale of Sweeney Todd's cutting off people's heads was disturbing my sleepy reverie. So I simply backed up and parroted one of his previous phrases to get him on another track. I parroted, "You said it had great music?" That did the trick. For the rest of the 45-minute trip to my home, Phil sang me the song Pretty Women and The Best Pies in London and other songs from Sweeney Todd. Much better accompaniment for my demi-nap. I'm sure to this day, Phil thinks of that trip as one of the best conversations we ever had. And all I did was parrot a few of his phrases. Technique number 20, parroting. Never be left speechless again. Like a parrot, simply repeat the last few words your conversation partner says. That puts the ball right back in his or her court, and then all you need to do is listen. 21. Here's how to get them happily chatting, so you can slip away if you want to. Use the encore technique. Every father smiles when his little tyke beseeches him at bedtime, "Daddy, Daddy, tell me the story again of the three little pigs, or the dancing princesses, or how you and Mommy met." Daddy knows Junior enjoyed the story so much the first time, he wants to hear it again and again and again. Junior inspires the following technique called encore, which serves two purposes. Encore makes a colleague feel like a happy dad, and it's a great way to give a dying conversation a heart transplant. I once worked on a ship that had Italian officers and mostly American passengers. Each week, the deck officers had to attend the captain's cocktail party. After the captain's address, in charmingly broken English, the officers invariably clumped together, yakking it up in Italian. Needless to say, most of the passengers' grasp of Italian ended at macaroni, spaghetti, salami, and pizza. As cruise director, it fell on my shoulders to get the officers to mingle with the passengers. My not-so-subtle tactic was to grab one of the officer's arms and literally drag him over to a smiling throng of expectant passengers. I would then introduce the officer and pray that either the cat would release his tongue or a passenger would come up with a more original question than, "Gee, if all the officers are here, who's driving the boat, hearty-har-har?" Never happened. I dreaded the weekly captain's cocktail party. One night, sleeping in my cabin, I was awakened by the ship rocking violently from side to side. I listened. The engines were off. That's a bad sign. I grabbed my robe and raced up to the deck. Through the dense fog, I could barely discern another ship, not half a mile from us. Five or six officers were grasping the starboard guardrail and leaning overboard. I rushed over just in time to see a man in the moonlight with a bandage over one eye, struggling up our violently rocking ladder. The officers immediately whisked him off to our ship's hospital. The engine started again, and we were on our way. The next morning, I got the full story. A laborer on the other ship, a freighter, had been drilling a hole in an engine cylinder. While he was working, a sharp, needle-thin piece of metal shot like a missile into his right eye. The freighter had no doctor on board, so the ship broadcast an emergency signal. International sea laws dictate that any ship hearing a distress signal must respond. Our ship came to the rescue, and the seaman, clutching his bleeding eye, was lowered into a lifeboat that brought him to our ship. Dr. Rossi, our ship's doctor, was successfully able to remove the needle from the workman's eye, thus saving his eyesight. Cut to the next captain's cocktail party. Once again, I was faced with a familiar challenge of getting officers to mingle and make small talk with the passengers. I made my weekly trek to the laconic officers' throng to drag one or two away, and this time my hand fell on the arm of the ship's doctor. I hauled him over to the nearest group of grinning passengers and introduced him. I then told them, "Just last week, Dr. Rossi saved the eyesight of a seaman on another ship. There was a dramatic midnight rescue. Dr. Rossi, I'm sure these folks would love to hear about it." It was like a magic wand. To my amazement, it was as though Dr. Rossi was blessed instantly with the tongues of angels. His previously monosyllabic broken English became thickly accented eloquence. He told the entire story to the growing group of passengers gathering around him. I left the throng that Dr. Rossi enraptured to pull another officer over to another awaiting audience. The captain's cocktail parties were a breeze for me for the rest of the season. The only problem was I noticed the stories were getting longer and more elaborate each time. Technique 21. Encore. The sweetest sound a performer can hear welling up out of the applause is, "Encore, encore, let's hear it again." The sweetest sound your conversation partner can hear from your lips when you're talking with a group of people is, "Tell them about the time you..." whatever. Whenever you're at a meeting or party with someone important to you, think of some stories he or she has told you. Choose an appropriate one from their repertoire that the crowd will enjoy. Then shine the spotlight by requesting a repeat performance. 22. Here's how to come across as a very positive person. use the accentuate the positive technique. Often people think when they meet someone they like, they should share a secret, reveal an intimacy, or make a confession of sorts to show that they're human too. Airing your youthful battle with bedwetting, teeth grinding, or thumb sucking, or your present struggle with goiter or gouter, supposedly endears you to the masses. Well, sometimes it does. But one study showed that if someone is above you in stature, their revealing a foible brings them closer to you. The holes in the bottom of Adlai Stevenson's shoes charmed a nation, as did the elder George Bush's shocking admission that he couldn't stand broccoli. If you're on a sure footing, say you're a superstar who wants to become friends with a fan, go ahead. Tell your devotees about the time you were out of work and penniless. But if you're not a superstar, better play it safe and keep the skeletons in the closet until later. People don't know you well enough to put your foible in context yet. Later in the relationship, telling your new friend that you've been thrice married, you got caught shoplifting as a teenager, and got turned down for a big job may be no big deal, and that may be the extent of what could be construed as black marks on an otherwise flawless life of solid relationships, no misdemeanors, and an impressive professional record. But very early in a relationship, the instinctive reaction is, well, what else is coming? If he shares that with me so quickly, what else is he hiding? A closet full of ex-spouses? A criminal record? Walls papered with rejection letters? Your new acquaintance has no way of knowing your confession was a generous act, a well-intentioned revelation on your part. Technique number 22. Accentuate the positive. When first meeting someone, lock your closet door and save your skeletons for later. You and your new good friend can invite the skeletons out, have a good laugh, and dance all over their bones later in the relationship. But now is the time, as the old song says, to accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative. 23. Here's how to always have something interesting to say. Use the latest news, don't leave home without it, technique. You've heard folks whine, I can't go to the party, I haven't got a thing to wear. But when was the last time you heard, I can't go to the party, I haven't got a thing to say? When going to a gathering with great networking possibilities, you naturally plan your outfit and make sure your shoes will match. And of course, you must have just the right tie or correct color lipstick. You puff your hair, pack your business cards, and you are off. Whoa, wait a minute. Didn't you forget the most important thing? What about the right conversation to enhance your image? Are you actually going to say anything that comes to mind, or doesn't, at the moment? You wouldn't don the first outfit your groping hand hits in the darkened closet. So you shouldn't leave your conversing to the first thought that comes to mind when you're facing a group of expectant, smiling faces. You will, of course, follow your instincts in conversation, but at least be prepared in case inspiration doesn't hit. Technique number 23. The latest news. Don't leave home without it. The last move to make before leaving for the party, even after you've given yourself final approval in the mirror, is to turn on the radio news or scan your newspaper. Anything that happened today is good material. Knowing the big deal news of the moment is also a defensive move that rescues you from putting your foot in your mouth by asking what everybody's talking about. Foot in mouth is not very tasty in public, especially when it's surrounded by egg on your face.